Welcome to Volante Elevate, where we explore what the world of payments will look like tomorrow by talking to the experts who are building it today. Your host for each episode, Volante's Chief Marketing Officer, Vinay Prabhakar. Ready to take your payments IQ to new heights? Let's get started.
Thanks, everybody, for joining this episode of Volante Elevate, which we have given the hopefully you think it's a fun title of ISO 20022 Everywhere All at Once. And that is because the pace of ISO 20022 adoption in the Americas, across the world, it continues to pick up, right? Fedwire is on track to migrate to ISO by the early 2025. We've got SWIFT, other cross-border payments doing that at the same time, already in transition. And pretty much all real-time instant payment schemes, including RTP, FedNow, SEPA Instant, they run on ISO 20022, right? So banks and financial institutions really faced with a significant challenge, and that is modernizing everything everywhere all at once, you know, just like the pressure the characters in that film faced. So in this episode, to talk about that, we are speaking with Michael Knorr, who is the transformation lead for the shared service operation at Wells Fargo, about the evolving ISO 20022 landscape and what financial institutions need to do to move beyond compliance and tap into the real power of this messaging standard. So welcome to Volante Elevate, Michael.
Thank you, Vinay. Thank you. Glad to be here, and really a fantastic title, I think. That's very fitting to what we're going to discuss.
Good, good. And hopefully by the end of the session, we can relieve some of the stress, you know, for our audience members with regard to ISO. So let's kick off, as we always do. Michael, tell us, tell our audience a little bit about your background, you know, and how you got into payments in ISO 20022.
Sure. I've been with Wells Fargo 10 years, and before that, over 18 years with Citibank, always in the payment space in different capacities, engaged with different market infrastructure things and new things that happen, right, in the marketplace. So I've been involved with, you know, CLS and Target 2 and other larger initiatives out there. And so looking at ISO 20022 from the start was sort of a logical next step. And, you know, as an overall industry expert and my involvement with the Payment Market Practice Group and its co-chair and different other local groups, they were always asked early on, right, to be part of the ISO 20022 initiative. Myself, I was part of the High Value Plus working group that actually started out with defining a lot of the base messages, how clearing systems are supposed to work in the ISO 2022 world, and had the opportunity to carry this forward, right, through my work with Payment Market Practice Group, and especially also here in the US for the US Market Practice Group, helping to define how we deal with ISO 2022, especially in this transition period, the coexistence periods where we have ISO already happening, right, in the interbank space, but, well, CHIPS is there now, but now Fedwire, right, not yet, right, and how are we handling this coexistence period?
And if I remember correctly from some of our earlier conversations, Michael, you were involved, should I say, at the inception of the euro? You were part of that effort.
Yep,
tell us a little bit about, you know, before we get into what's going on now. Tell us about that history.
Thank you. Yes, Vinay. I was part of when the market worked on the clearing system readiness for the Economic and Monetary Union, EMU, right? So the introduction of the euro back in the day in 1999, long time, I'm dating myself, right? But that was also around, right? A lot of how do we standardize quickly, right? Different systems had to come together to form the first version of Target. Obviously, that has gone to multiple iterations, and Target 2 just migrated to ISO 20022 last year in March, right? So that has obviously a long history to it of just building something from with the existing systems and interlinking infrastructure that then led obviously to Target and into this multiple iterations. But all of them were around industry corporations setting standards and having really good dialogue, right, in the markets. What do we do, right? Well, we know where we want to end up, right? There are transitional arrangements that need to be put in place that market participants were eager to agree to, right? Some rules of the road, right, and market practices. And that's sort of how I got into that space, right, through my engagement with Euro, CLS, right? They all had this similar component that required cross-bank cooperation to define sort of requirements from a technical, but also very much so from a business perspective, how we reduce friction in that space.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if you agree with this, that when you look at payments on narrow timescales, okay, meaning a month, 6 months, whatever, things don't seem to change too much. You know, the same payment types, the same approaches. But if you look at like late 90s to now, right, those are and the timescales of, let's say, 2 to 3 year blocks or 5 year blocks. Things are pretty different, right? We have ISO 20022 going on. We've got real-time payments going on. As you mentioned, you know, Target then became Target 2 and is continuing on. SEPA became SEPA Instant or added SEPA Instant. So there's always a lot of change in payments. And I think it's fair to say that the spirit of everything everywhere all at once, you know, we're at a time of major change in the payments landscape right now. So let's dive into some of the specifics of those changes in the U.S. domestic landscape, right? So can you tell us about particularly what's going on with Fedwire and the Fedwire ISO 20022 migration?
Yeah, sure. And as we say, the Fedwire migration to ISO is not a standalone initiative. It's part of a larger roadmap also for the modernization of the US payment system, right? That started many years ago with decisions to upgrade the technology in Fedwire, right? That actually runs even the current system already. It started with a decision to actually promote even instant payments and create such an environment, right, for the US. And also the decision to actually jump on the bandwagon, right, with other market infrastructures to adopt ISO 20022. To reduce sort of friction in the global payment system, right? So it's sort of interlinked, right, with the overall objectives, right, of market infrastructures and regulators to try to reduce friction, improve harmonization, and have sort of flow money more freely, actually from a technical sense, right? There are many, obviously, obstacles from a regulatory and sanction perspective, but at least from a technical level, big effort over the years to reduce these technical barriers of multi-translations, right? And how we have more common understanding of data elements and payments. And that's also, you know, where we're going with Fedwire, right? Now, as part of that, right, the industry is now middle of actually the preparation for that, which leads then to March of next year, March 25, where Fedwire will do what we call a single day migration from legacy format into the new ISO 2022 format. Now, the US industry should have a little bit practice now because we just did this in April of this year when CHIPS, not all US banks are members of CHIPS, but the larger money market center banks are, had already to go through that, right, and adopt ISO 2022 for CHIPS. And we also had a single day migration, right, that the market did quite successfully, to be honest, right? Now we're on sort of halfway already, right, there from a US perspective, where CHIPS is using already ISO 2022, and Fedwire will do so next March. At one point, there was discussion around doing both systems at the same time, but due to risks, it was decided, no, let's have some time between those, right? And then the Fed and the vendors mainly that support us, banks, were also asking not to keep the Fedwire ISO migration too close, right, to the introduction of FedNow, right, the big instant payment system that was put live last summer, also quite successfully, and that always requires a lot of effort from banks and the vendor community, obviously, to get there. So the request was, let's spread this out a bit to get FedNow done in 2023, do CHIPS in 2024. And then in 25 in March, focus on the Fedwire migration in preparation for, obviously, where SWIFT would like to go next November, start phasing out, right, some of the legacy payment messages, at least, right,
year, November. And with regard to that Fedwire migration in March of next year, that's the deadline, right? Just to break it down for the audience. So basically, from the perspective of a bank or a financial institution that wants to provide Fedwire services or does provide Fedwire services to its customers and is connected to the Fed directly or indirectly, I suppose. What that means is that the systems they use to send and receive messages between the institution and the Fed will need to be ISO 20022 fluent, let's say, or will need to speak that language, send those messages, receive those messages, understand them. And the drop dead date is March 2025, but presumably many are need to be in testing by now. And in fact, I think there's a requirement that they begin their testing by the end of the year. Is that a correct understanding that I have?
Yes. I mean, the test environment itself that the Fed provides, or their DIT environment, has been stood up, right, exactly for that purpose, to allow banks to start testing, and the vendors, right? So this environment has been there already for quite some time, I think since the end of last year, I think, for banks to do that, because the requirements, or the technical requirements, were already sort of finalized, set in stone, right? And that test environment is available for all the banks, right, to actually, and vendors to start testing with, right? So some of them are already, right, in process. I think all the vendors are certified already with the FedWire infrastrasture.
Correct.
And
yeah,
so they're ready now, right? You guys were part of that, right?
Yes.
And they're ready now to support their customers like us, right? And they're working through that. So that's the next phase, right? To then have the banks obviously install their ISO compatible compliant code, and then sort of connect to the FedWire ISO testing environment to start testing and certifying on that.
So from the perspective of, again, that bank or financial institution that is maybe not yet started that journey, right? Or is it the beginning of that journey? Can you kind of go through what are the options, right? And what works or doesn't work for an institution, a tier one systemically important institution like Wells Fargo, you know, may not be appropriate for a mid-tier bank or a community bank or what have you. So can you just go through what are the bank's options in terms of complying with this, but then also in the future, getting the value right out of ISO 20022?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, same on the SWIFT or CHIP side. There are different options how to get there. So ideally, right, you want to have a fully ISO compliant wire transfer backend system. So that's still the dream,
sure,
right? That's where you want to go, right? So we want to really highlight that to say that's should be the target state. But obviously, depends when you start it. This might not be possible anymore in the short period of time that's left. So one might need to look at translation options, right, between whatever your internal wire formats are and the wire formats, you know, in this case for FedWire, right? So put a component between the funds transfer system and the FedWire interface, right, to provide that translation into FedWire compliant outbound messages. And then obviously the messages that are coming back to translate them in a way that the backend can support it, right? So that's probably a lot of, some banks will need to go down this route giving the time. The unique thing in the US market is there's obviously many banks out there that fully rely on third-party vendors to get them towards FedWire, right? So the bank itself is sort of has outsourced, right, most of their wire transfer processing to a third-party technology vendor that runs this infrastructure for them, and they might have different options in place, right, because they also run different versions of their software, right? So some might be, yep, we're native, while others might also, right, work on translation components, right, either through external translation engine or building the translations themselves, right, because many of the internal wire transfer logic might be fairly complex, and then changing this all to ISO native might take longer than originally anticipated, right? Hopefully some of the vendors gained some valuable experience last year from getting their customers ready, right, for FedNow, building some of that. Some of that should, you know, definitely from probably a schema reading perspective, should be probably available, right, for FedWire as well. So definitely being familiar with that, right, should really help. But yes, right. So I think we'll see definitely different translation solutions there as well, depending on size of bank, to just get there for March, right? And that means also a lot of these will be sort of more like for like, and that means maybe some of the data richness that these messages have natively might not be leverageable immediately, right? Because if you stick more with a like-for-like approach in your translations, then some of the newer data elements that don't have an equivalent necessarily in the legacy world might not be available, right? I mean, you might map them in free format on your inbound side, because obviously you need to have put them somewhere, right? But you might not be able to provide any value add solutions on them, right? Or provide them necessarily to the customer in a nice structured interface, right? So that will require a little bit more time, right? For the market to accomplish that.
So if we, and that's fair, and the data element is a really important part of this, which I want to get into a little separately, because it also applies, I think, to the cross-border transition, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the goal is to get that all-at-once value right out of the data in ISO 20022 once the data is there. But again, just to boil it down for our audience at this point, then U.S. financial institutions have a few options. U.S. institutions, meaning those that are either U.S. domiciled or do any business here, right, through the Fedwire system. There are translation options where you can translate old into new and back and forth. And then from there on, it could be anything from just putting in a tactical translation solution to actually replacing the system, right, that they have. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps, depending on the provider that they're working with, you know, doing an upgrade. And we know that upgrades can be challenging because often you have to go to a completely new version, right, mm-hmm. of an existing product. And if you have to go to a completely new version anyway, at least in our experience, what a lot of institutions do is they say, well, if you have to go to a completely new version anyway, it's essentially a new product. You know, let's look in the market. But that does take time. And so the way we work with our own customers at Volante, and just for full disclosure, Wells Fargo is a customer of Volante and an investor, is really, it's not one size fits all, right? So we do have customers that we work with where we are putting in a translation solution for them, and we can do that fairly quickly. Even more complex projects, we've got a pretty standard 14-week timeline, really to take you from start to finish. Start being you don't have anything, finish being you are compliant. And the good news is, you know, where we are today, there's still time, you know, for the end of the year to start those projects. Let's do the following. I want to talk about the data aspect, but let's expand out a bit and go to cross-border payments. Yeah, you mentioned that all of these things are falling quickly on the heels of the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if it's March 25 for Fedwire, and then it's, I think you said October or November of next year, 2025. For SWIFT and cross-border payments. Okay, so tell us about that. What's going on with CPPR Plus, SWIFT, the G20, all of those things that you're involved in globally as well, please.
Yeah, sure, Vinay, happy to. As we mentioned initially, right, the everything all at once is a little bit driven by the global community, right? Fedwire itself as a pure domestic system probably wouldn't have needed, right, to adopt ISO 2022. But the position of the US dollar as the leading cross-border currency, supporting, you know, just the volume of flows we do that are cross-border related in the value perspective are tremendous. It's really the main, well, trading currency for all capital markets, FX products, right, around the globe. And yes, while the efforts in the way in some regions to decouple a little bit, right, from the US dollar, it's still, right, the most dominant currency that's there. And that also leads to certain, I would say, responsibility, right, of be it us banks and the market infrastructure providers to really provide an environment that's compatible, right, with sort of the global financial mechanics, right, and that's sort of ISO 2022. Other markets have adopted this much earlier in the US, so be it in Asia, South Africa, parts of Europe, right, that this was definitely the right decision, right, to align and saying, yes, if now the global community is ready to fully adopt it, then we should also give our proprietary formats and move to ISO 2022. So the migration we see here obviously is closely aligned to what happens in the rest of the world, where SWIFT had also a multi-year plan to migrate from the legacy MT messages into the what we call in SWIFT terms the CBPR plus MX messages, right, on their network.
And the MX are the ISO 2022.
The ISO, right. And MX means ISO 2022.
MT being the legacy ones, yeah.
Right. MX means ISO 2022 messages on the FinPlus network. It's sort of extension of the Fin network that Swift runs. It provides additional validations, right, and control processes, right, for bank messaging, basically, right. And when ISO 2022 messages are transmitted, right, through FinPlus, we refer to them as MX, and the legacy messages as MT. That's sort of where that nomenclature sort of comes from. And that migration started last year in March, with sort of a little bit big bang, right, of certain market infrastructures in Europe and, well, Asia, as well as, well, Canada even, right, migrating to ISO 2022, and then Swift providing full support for these MX messages on FinPlus based on the CBPR Plus standard of ISO 2022. And that began this period of coexistence, right, which means Swift is supporting MX and MT messages in parallel until November 2025 next year. Now, originally the plan was to have everything migrated, right? Not just the payments, but also cash reporting by that time. Well, reality has set in that focus right now is really for the banks to really focus on the payment messages, MT-102s, MT-103s, 22s, 101s and so forth, right? To get those into the MX message standard, right? And not enough time has been spent really to worrying about the reporting messages. So Swift is focused on, right, where we can to retire, right, MT payment messages November next year, but a lot of the reporting messages, investigation messages, MT-940s, 950s, 199s, and so forth, will still be around. So an official retirement date hasn't been really put forward yet, right? So Swift board that will need to look at that again. So far, market, let's focus on the payment side, right? We'll continue to support, obviously, also MX reporting, but it might take longer, right, to get this implemented, right? Yeah. And that also shows that maybe the effort was bigger, right, than initially thought, partially, and you guys know, right? I mean, you're in the business. Banks have a lot of disparate systems between payments engine, reporting engines, DDA platforms, right? It's not just one thing that can be sort of upgraded and then everything works, right? It's just there's so many different applications, some vendor supported, some homegrown, and that adds to the complexity and especially the testing time between all these systems until we get there, right, to truly native payment processing and native reporting. Right, so we'll go through multiple phases there, and also the market took a little bit longer to also develop some newer messages. For example, focusing on investigations, we just only worked with ISO 2022 to actually define new investigation messages, right, to support investigations that are today freeform through new standardized investigation messages, which have been registered with ISO under CEMT 110 and CEMT 111. So they're available on as a definition, but not yet implemented on the Swift network. So the community is still working on defining the usage guidelines, right? How to even implement them. So those had to be laid as well to 2026, basically.
2026,
right?
Okay.
We could really worry about them, right?
And if we look at cross-border versus domestic, if you will, right? Is it generally the case that one is more complex than the other? You know, that the bank's cross-border system is going to be harder to adapt to ISO 22 versus domestic? Or, you know, does it really depend on the situation?
Well, I would say that since the payment chains are longer, right, for cross-border, that's a little bit where the complexity comes in, right? Domestically, you either have a custom on your books, or you send through the clearing system, Fedwire, right? And that's the end of it. And the information is more limited, right? Regarding if all parties are domestic, right? You don't worry about intermediaries, foreign currencies. In the US, we don't have any deductions, right? Becomes simpler.
Yes.
Once we go into cross-border, payment chains become longer, more settlement options take place, and we have more topics around routing and party identifications, right? And charge codes and charge processing that don't really exist, right, in in domestic processing. So that makes it more complex. On top of, right, stricter regulatory requirements, sanctions screening, AML reporting, right? So you have now new data. So all your respective sanction screening platforms, AML platforms with longer payment chains, more data elements, right, all need to be upgraded, right, to be able to support those details, right, in appropriately, right?
Interesting.
So that actually raises the bar.
Any organization with meaningful volume, right, in cross-border payments is going to have to be prepared for complexity, and perhaps even, as you're pointing out, greater complexity than the equivalent domestic, right, RTGS type of transaction, which I think opens up an interesting question for us, right? The cross-border flows are typically part of a bank's correspondent banking business, right? So if we look at the world of correspondent banking, I think I'm correct in saying that correspondent bank is dominated by a few, banking is dominated by a few large players, of which I believe Wells Fargo is one. And though the number of those players has gone down or reduced over time, right? If we look compared to 10 years ago, there are banks who are reducing their focus on correspondent banking and getting out of it. So I'm wondering, is, you know, what's going on there behind the scenes? Is correspondent banking a less viable business because of all the compliance and so forth? Is it because of competition from, you know, newfangled cross-border payment services? Tell us a bit about the landscape of correspondent banking as a business.
Yeah, definitely competition has shifted, right? 10 years ago, we're just looking at ourselves amongst the banks, right? Now it obviously depends on sort of use case and payment type. Competition or new competitors in the form of fintechs, right, have obviously emerged. Definitely remittance payments, right, have seen much more competition than, let's say, wholesale payments, of course, right? But some of the fintech companies also trying to get more into corporate-to-corporate traffic, right? We have Visa and MasterCard building propositions in that space, which is putting more pressure, right, definitely on the banks, right, to further develop their product propositions. The idea is also with ISO 2022 and different regulatory initiatives under the G20 to see how do we level the playing field more, in a sense, and keep everybody follow everybody the same sort of rules, right, in this space. So that also should hopefully enable banks, with the standards all the same, at least technically, should make it, you know, hopefully easier maybe to offer these services again. However, you know, they're beyond sort of your processing complexities, right? You're right, regulatory sanctions and AML and the risk program sitting on top of it, quite a big cost burden, right? That only the bigger banks, right, can now sort of afford. But one could argue, right, that data standardization, more granular data, should also enable more third-party solutions to automate many of those compliance functions, right? Today, a lot of data is sort of, let's say, free format, sort of data prep, manual lookups, right, is required. For example, right, country codes, not standardized in payment messages, right? Somebody uses, Deutschland, not Germany, or not the ISO code, right? Becomes more complex, and you have manual, people need to look at things, right? As move with ISO, dedicated ISO country codes, town names and fields, right? Should hopefully help to automate a lot of the data prep, right? And then having more intelligent software, maybe AI, right? To start building topologies, right? Automatically, right? On maybe financial crimes, right? And enable sort of bring the cost down maybe in that space to automate more. So we'll see, right? I mean, data is only one aspect for it, right? It's maybe the necessary foundation for it, right? Obviously, regulators need to be also be on board with some of these potential automations, so shared utilities, right? That could lead to that. I mean, definitely G20, right? Is interested to figure out how access to payment corridors, which means, right, make getting correspondent banks also more comfortable again to have a broader scope, right? How to enable that, right? Which means, yes, there are technical prep work, ISO falls under that, but also more on harmonized approach, on regulatory approach, right? That is needed, and that's all part of these discussions by regulators to see how can we get there, right? To reduce some of that friction without compromising, in a sense, on sort of safety, right? Be it on cyber crimes, right, or other financial crimes, right? But aligning, right, certain expectations based on the data, better definitions, hopefully gets us there, right? But it's a scale business, right? So bigger players do have an advantage. That led obviously to consolidations in that space. But correspondent banking is still very, very much necessary. And also we have seen in crises, there's a limit how much you can concentrate. So there is definitely the need to ensure you have sufficient number of viable players, right, in each currency in place to support it, right, from a risk mitigation strategy, avoid concentration risks, right?
In terms of the viability of that space, right, I think it's fair to say that even some of the fintechs, you know, who are providing these cross-border payment services, in the end, they need to work with banks. And there's probably a correspondent banking network that sits behind those transactions anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although, again, some of them are more based on blockchain or card rails and actually don't use the traditional correspondent banking rails. So it's certainly an interesting landscape with increasing diversity. But the thing is, if it's all the same types of transactions and they just all move to ISO 20022, we're talking now here about SWIFT and traditional cross-border flows, then there's not really much value being added, right? We're just changing message standard and kind of doing the same thing. So this, I think, helps us bring us back full circle almost to the promise of the data in ISO 20022. And I think you referred to a couple of use cases or possible advantages, but maybe we can drill into those for the next couple of minutes, which is to say, all right, once all of this is ISO 20022 fluent, capable, native, what have you, right? What are the opportunities, right? Why is this good for the industry as a whole to have all these domestic payment types, cross-border payment types running ISO 20022 as a common messaging standard?
Well, the main advantage, right, and that's why ISO 20022 was invented in the first place, is avoiding a lot of translations between different systems and payment types. Historically, if we look back, right, each payment systems almost had their own format, right? Batch-driven payment systems in different countries, right? Doesn't matter if it's Europe, Asia, and the US will still have, right? NACHA files.
We do. Very true. We do.
We're all different. And fintechs, as well as banks, have figured out ways to, don't use the term interlink, but translate sometimes, right, between these different message types for different purposes and reasons. And that's always time consuming. Corporates have different formats as well, right? So a lot of translation, potential of data loss, cost to maintain the maps, and sometimes so that's the semantics. The meaning of the data might even change, or it's not clear, not compatible. And that's what we're trying to do with ISO, right? So the ISO standards, we're trying to get everybody, I mean, that's a dream, right? Everybody along the payment chain, the initiation from corporates to all of us in the middle, as well as the reporting, including reporting to governments, right? On the same standard. So we don't have a issue of the meaning of data, right? Of what we mean, right? By a certain value date, by timestamps, by reference data, right? To see, okay, there's a field for an IBAN, this is the field for an LEI or BIC code. If I see it, I can look up reference data, right? Which is standardized, right? Brings sort of great efficiency in the process. So that standardization itself is very important. Now what's necessary then, obviously, is needs to follow with willingness of the banks, but a little bit also top down, right? And that's where mentioned again, so the G20 initiative, regulatory initiatives that are pushing towards data standardization, sort of, great, you guys have now a common data standard. What do you put in the little fields? What's all required? Let's agree, okay, for the address to be the minimum address requirements is the following, right? We need the town, we need the country. The country code needs to be in the ISO format, right? If you have a corporate entity, let's push for getting a unique identifier for each entity, right? Corporate entity, right? So it might be the LEI, for example. So you can do
the LEI being legal identity.
Legal, sorry, right, forget the range.
Legal entity.
Legal
identifier.
Entity identifier. Yeah. It's, yeah. It's a global initiative by the Goliath Foundation. It's sort of a also G20 initiative that came out of the financial crisis, right, after 2008, to really develop a unique identifier for counterparties, right? So initially it was more capital markets, and now we're trying to figure out how we can use this in payments. Requires some more adjustments. It's not 100% there yet, but the idea is the same, right? You have a unique identifier, globally available data, so you can easily redo, or technically, guys, we call it entity resolution, right? You look up, right? Mm-hmm. Who the party behind the ideas, right? The full name, the address, maybe the industry type doesn't exist yet, but would be great, right? Instead of, you know, we do a lot of requests for information sometimes. If we don't know who a party is, okay, we also ask, you know, what industry are they part of? Now, if we have standard industry codes that say, okay, this is, I don't know, this is an oil and gas company, or this is a company in the food sector, right? There are unique codes that could be attached to that reference data, right? In addition to name and address, right? So that would, you know, would definitely makes that easier, hopefully, right, for from regulatory perspective and other risk management practices, but also for the initiator, right? If we think about all the fraud that's happening out there, creates a lot of costs in the industry, because it's easier eventually to validate as a receiving bank a unique number, right, a BIC or LEI against your database, then do name and account number matching, which is much, much harder, right, with all the variations
that's
in
true.
That space, no, right? That, having a unique number. Say, okay, does the number on the inbound message correspond to a number in my customer database that's mapped to this account? Clear. Computers are great at it. You don't need to look at all these letter combinations, right? Much cleaner, right? So that's where obviously the push comes a little bit from regulators to say, hey, right, industry, we think, right, that you have a smoother running process if you have these unique IDs, right? At least for the corporates. Doesn't exist for individuals. Obviously, we have a lot of data privacy concerns and so forth, right? Wouldn't work having a global ID for that. But, you know, the haystack would get smaller with all corporate traffic, right? Identified uniquely with these IDs. It's then easier to tell apart what's a retail flows for consumers and purely corporate, right? Would greatly make certain things easier, right, for banks, right, in that
right.
in that space,
banks and,
right,
and their customers, right, whether
correct
businesses or consumers, and one of the things that we're certainly excited about is that connection between what we're talking about today, ISO 20022, in the realm of domestic and cross-border payments, with the fact that real-time payment networks, right, SEPA Instant, FedNow, RTP, and so on, they're all in ISO 20022. And they have interesting message types like request for pay or request to pay, which allow for this supply chain information, purchase orders, bills, invoices to be integrated into the payment flows. And with everything in ISO 20022, you know, I would hope then there's also more economies of scale in terms of banks working with fintech partners who can provide payments intelligence solutions to look across all of that data, right? So now if you can do request for pay or invoicing and other supply chain documents through the real-time network, you should be able to do it through the cross-border network as well, because many of the messages are similar. And in the long run, that should also help connect domestic real-time payment networks to global cross-border, so that, you know, we can maybe have a future in which payments are not just, you know, ISO 20022 risk, not just real time, but also not just domestically, but also in a cross-border context. So that is exciting stuff. Probably a topic for another episode by itself, you know, that whole connection between real time and cross-border. But I think we are just about out of time today. Michael, I'd like to thank you for helping us demystify a little bit this complex world of ISO 20022 and get a little bit of the everything everywhere all at once stress out of the system. Hopefully those of you who've been listening have a few ideas now on how to approach your ISO 20022 transformation, and we look forward, Michael, to having you back on another episode to drill down further into these topics, and you know, maybe the next one is on real-time cross-border as well. So once again, thanks so much, Michael Noor, transformation lead for the Wells Fargo Shared Services operation. Thanks for joining us today.
Vinay, thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that episode of Volante Elevate, where we explore what the world of payments will look like tomorrow by talking to the experts who are building it today. Subscribe to Volante Elevate on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Podbean, or visit us on www.volantetech.com/volante-elevate.